Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday morning. It is the 27th of October, and a delight to have you all with us. A week to go before Election Day 2020. Yes, we have made it this far, and we will continue to do so, I'm sure, as we plot along and talk about what's going on in the world today. A lot to talk about, a great group to do it with, so let's get started. A reminder that you can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm good, you know, because it's so dark early in the morning, I have to walk with a light on my head. You know, I have a headlight.
Yeah.
You put it around your forehead and you walk down the thing there. You know.
You get bugs? The bugs come to the
light? No bugs, but there are crazy drivers.
Yeah.
They see you coming, they don't move over a little bit. So you got to move into the grass. It's not fun, but hey, you got to do it.
That's right.
Everybody says you walk, you get 3 extra years on your life, maybe.
Depends on if you get hit by a car or not, but sure, yeah.
There is that.
Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is with us. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm well and happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo also making up the panel this morning. Hello. Good morning.
Hello.
And the Empire Report's J.P. Miller is here. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
J.P.
Joe, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. Great group today. As I said in the billboard this morning, it's like our classic edition panel. It's just great. Just all the three who have been here since the beginning, they all work together great. They're fantastic, and we're going to have a good discussion about what's going on. So yesterday, to the surprise of absolutely no one, but it still is newsworthy nonetheless, that Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed to the Supreme Court. The conservative majority in the court has now been cemented. A bitterly divided Senate confirmed Barrett as the 115th justice to the Supreme Court on Monday, elevating just the fifth woman to the court in its 231-year history, and one who further cements its conservative shift, a legacy that will last even if Republicans lose power in next week's elections. The vote was 52-48 for Barrett, President Trump's third nominee to the Supreme Court. The 48-year-old jurist solidifies a judicial legacy for the White House and Senate Republicans that also includes dozens of younger and more ideological conservative judges on the federal appeals court. Alan, we'll begin with you.
Well, what's to say? As you said, Joe, we knew that this was coming. It's a great shame in that the hypocritical Republicans in the Senate refused to let Obama make a choice a year away from being appointed, and they have left now somebody who has been appointed by a few votes and confirmed by a few votes, and it really is awful. Now the court itself is showing its cards already. They're saying they're doing everything they can to cement Trump's election. They're saying in Wisconsin, we're not going to allow people's votes to be counted after the date and all the rest. And it is a terror for many people who have always believed in the court, to the point that, you know, there are increasing calls for some kind of remediation, the possibility of adding some extra justices or making it clear that the Congress will not go along with all of the cases that get to the Supreme Court, because in many cases the court does not have original jurisdiction, and then the Congress can sort of lay out what they get and what they don't get, and I have a feeling we're going to see some of that.
So I don't quite, and Mike, I'm going to have you help me on this. I don't quite understand the decision made by the Supreme Court in regards to Wisconsin yesterday, because what they said is that the ballots, the absentee ballots, had to be at the Board of Elections by Election Day, as opposed to 3 days later, meaning I could mail it tomorrow and it would have up until that time to arrive at the Board of Elections. But what I don't quite understand is, wasn't that always the rule in Wisconsin, that it was always the rule. Gorsuch wrote, I believe, in the decision yesterday, saying that what he was objecting to was the fact that a judge would make that decision as to when you would have ballots up until what point you would have ballots counted, as opposed to the state officials.
Well, different states have different rules on how many days after Election Day they can receive a ballot and still count it. I think it's like 7 or 9 for New York. But so this kind of a thing is like looking for loopholes to back those who say that that would be problematic. It's really an over insertion into a state issue. It should have just let the state rule go, unless there was some compelling evidence that the rule was unfair. And 3 days is more than reasonable, but there will be votes that come in afterwards. So arguably, you know, if the Postal Service was overwhelmed, like some are in certain parts of the country, because of the number of absentee ballots being filed, it's completely reasonable for a court to intervene to do that. But for a court to take an action that's going to reverse that, It just plays into the whole narrative that this court is doing exactly what Alan said, that they've already taken this opportunity to assert they're going to back the Trump side when it comes to issues of the election that go before the court. And that is frightening a week before such an essential existential election.
So, Rosemary, go ahead.
I was just going to say one other thing real fast, Joe. Not only that, this is the president who tried to basically break the Postal Service. So first he says, okay, we want to make sure that the Postal Service can't do its job. And then they say, because it's not doing its job, we're gonna uphold a rule that people can't vote. It's beyond belief.
Rosemary, how does this differ from the decision that came down that was basically believed to have favored the Democrats in Pennsylvania?
Well, the rule that the Supreme Court seems to be following is that you can have no new election laws this close to an election, which actually in the abstract makes a lot of sense to me. And I have no problem faulting Democrats throughout the country who have waited now until minutes before this current election to start taking steps that could have been done in 2016 when we began seeing problems. So that's part of it. I want to say that ceremony last night was horrifying on many levels. When Trump brought his new Supreme Court justice, and I used the possessive on purpose, to the White House, Barack Obama he never did that. His two appointees were sworn in at the court, which is a symbol that they are independent from the White House. No. Amy was right there in a repeat of the Rose Garden. So it was an insult on the judicial front and on the health front. They redid the Rose Garden super spreader event, this time with a mass. And she picked to hold the Bible on which she took her oath, Clarence Thomas, who is both a sexual predator, I believe, and the most conservative member of the court. She is the most conservative member now. I think she will go to the right of him. And also I read she is the first person to put on the court without any bipartisan support at all, not one Democratic vote since 1869. Which is also symbolic, because I think that's where we're going to take the judiciary in this country with her appointment. So the next step now, I think, is for Democrats to get in there and take the bold action that they did not take when Obama was in office and afterward. Add extra judges. I hope Barack Obama and a black woman will be among them, and start looking at our laws on abortion and on voting rights, because what the court has undone, the Congress can fix.
JP.
I actually was surprised that Barrett actually got through. You know, I kept waiting for through this month-long process, I kept waiting for some kind of bombshell to drop, something maybe not similar to what happened to Kavanaugh, but some kind of move by the Democrats to really try and block this nominee. And it seems like they, you know, while they put up the good fight, there was not a big moment where her confirmation was seemingly in jeopardy. I thought it was interesting that the Republicans waited until just 1 week before the election to, you know, for this to happen. And I also note that Susan Collins voted against her. That means that Susan Collins is in deep trouble in Maine. I believe that there's already been over $60 million in TV ads spent in Maine, which means, you know, that there are no advertisements for Clorox, bleach, or Cheerios anymore. It's just all political advertisements. And so I think that on election night we can look to Maine to see whether Susan Collins can hang on and whether this vote against Amy Coney Barrett is enough to allow her to win.
Do you think, Alan, that she has the shot of winning?
No. I think this is just the final nail in her political coffin, to be honest with you. You know, that she thinks that if it's way too late to be showing this kind of independence. You know, what people were furious with her about is that she kept saying she was going to do things and she didn't do them. No, I think the polls are showing that she's in real trouble.
I call baloney on this being any kind of an act of independence. She would not be doing it if Mitch didn't say, yeah, we got the votes, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I think the optics of doing this so close to the election, when they've had the stimulus package hanging there since June and haven't done anything on that, it could really backfire all across the country, especially as, and we'll talk about it, I'm sure, as the COVID numbers are hitting record highs.
I do think that JP makes a great point that I would like to explore just for a moment, that we were expecting more of a fight. We were expecting... I don't know. Do you think it was the president getting COVID? Do you think it was just the increase in numbers? Do you think it was limited options for the Democrats that there wasn't more? Because it seemed at the beginning, at some point, this was going to be a knockout, drag-out fight, which we didn't see at all.
Well, what could they have done, Joe? That's the question. What could the Democrats have done? I asked Chuck Schumer. He said, oh, we got big plans. We're going to fight them on the beaches. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But in the end, they had no ammunition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I agree.
Well, part
of it, I think,
because she lied. She hid her involvement as a member of a board of the school that did not hire gay teachers and would not let kids come to the school if their parents were gay. Ridiculous. And it was also rushed, that there wasn't time to do the sort of deep dive. I suspect that we'll find out things about her increasingly now that there's, you know, there's no deadline.
Mike?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think the Democrats were very, very careful not to be attacking her personally. She certainly is an exemplary person when it comes to family and to adopting children and to raising her family in a faith that many people embrace, and that's all to be respected. And to attack her personally, I think, would have really backfired on the Democrats. So it did. It robbed them of any ammunition here. But you're right, Rosemary. If there was a longer, more thoughtful process where you could bring up her past comments, her past writings, her past affiliations, and talk about how those would play into her role as a Supreme Court justice, it may have convinced people to you know, maybe take a step back and question whether this is the right justice for this time. And none of that could happen. You know, McConnell said that this was all perfectly legal, and he's right, but that doesn't make it the right thing to do. It is such a highly politicized time. And as you guys pointed out, it was completely a partisan vote without any Democrats supporting it. It really rips apart a country when we're already being completely torn apart. It's just the wrong thing at the wrong time.
JP?
And I, you know, all this stuff about what an exemplary life she leads, she never got asked the question that I have, which is, do you feel at all icky about being used as a tool in this way by the president?
Good question.
Accepting a nomination under these terms, you really think this is great for the country? Is that what you think the founding fathers had in mind?
JP?
Yeah, I was actually looking in the newspaper to see whether there were any Democratic votes. I was thinking after Dianne Feinstein's comments about what an exemplary candidate she was and how good the hearings were, I was thinking that potentially Senator Feinstein would vote for Amy Coney Barrett. I also read in the newspaper that Chuck Schumer said that he gave Senator Feinstein a strong talking to, which I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to listen to that strong talking to between Schumer and Feinstein. But yes, it was a straight party line vote. And in fact, you could say it was a bipartisan vote against, with Susan Collins joining the minority.
Point. Hey, I'd just like to say that I agree with Rosemary about having Clarence Thomas do it. It was almost like the neocon on the bench said, "Welcome aboard to our team."
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Yes, that and sort of a na-na-na, right? I mean,
yeah. Yep.
You know, the proof is going to be in the pudding here. Is she going to vote along with the president? As he suggests she will, when he says he wants her on the court, so he brings it no matter what, no matter how absurd, no matter how obscene, will she vote along with him? I say she will. And that may destroy a lot of the ideas about what a brilliant and fair juror she is.
It would.
I will take it all back if she recuses herself. And I do think that John Roberts may talk to her about that, as I've said, but I cannot see it happening.
Recusing herself and, in a case in regards to the
election case.
It's a solving election, because Trump made it so obvious that he was putting her on because he wanted someone there for the elections, that that seems to me a very decent reason to recuse herself. But
do you think that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh should also recuse themselves or no?
Nope. Because in those cases, the president said, "Oh, I want conservatives on there," which they plainly are. In this case, he specifically said, "Oh, I got to have 9 justices on there for this election." Direct a connection. Do you see the difference? I mean, JP.
Yeah,
but it's even worse than that.
We have to take a break. But go ahead.
Go. Well, it's even worse than that. She said, "I want him there for me if I bring a case there." It couldn't have been more laid out.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Keep them short. Keep them to the point. We'd love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. A lot of questions from our listeners regarding the Supreme Court appointment of Justice Barrett. And we go to Kevin, who says, if Amy Coney Barrett had any shred of integrity, why would she consent to being confirmed under these circumstances? A sad day for us all. And that is a point that Rosemary made earlier. We go to Mark, who said, recently I heard a Republican guest on C-SPAN claim without explanation that the Democrats could have forced a vote on Merrick Garland nomination but chose not to fight and use every option available to them. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, I've said that repeatedly. They were complacent, thinking Hillary Clinton would win and all would be well, and they did not force it. They could even have brought that issue before the Supreme Court and might well have won under a court that existed then. But now, okay, in the past, lesson learned, bold action is definitely required now should the Democrats get into power.
All right, let's go to Tori. I don't get it. Can someone explain to me why the narrative of Democrats has been a fear for the ACA and Amy Coney Barrett's fitness for office and not the blatant hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans? It seems
I think it's fair to say that we have all said that before. So it's not as if the Democrats haven't said it. They say it over and over again. Where do we get the idea that they haven't said it?
It seems to me that Democrats should have been shouting this hypocrisy from the mountaintops and forcing Republicans to explain their logic, because clearly they have none. Instead, it was a muted argument playing second fiddle to the nominee herself. Why on earth did Democrats have to gain? What on earth did Democrats have to gain by this? Help me understand, asks Tory. Go to Anthony. What is your intention in the constant prejudgment and condemnation of the new justice before she has had a say in any case before the court? Isn't she entitled to be innocent before proven? Question mark. The constant.
No, that's the whole idea of advise and consent of the Senate, is you vet somebody and make sure she's what you want before you put her on to be making decisions that are not just like a test. They affect lives, and especially this justice, who will come in and her first decisions will be about voting rights and health care.
All right.
In the middle of a pandemic.
Save
it. No, I don't want someone learning on the job.
All right. just save it, because there's more anger toward us in this letter from Anthony. Like the constant venting of bias and hatred, in your broadcast leave little to nothing for its credibility. Better to discuss pros and cons of actual testimony and legal argument. Or are you no better than the hate mongers you love to speak against? Our divided culture needs honest thinking from both sides of the issue.
Well, I have to say at this point, all we have now is to wait and see what the next step by Amy Coney Barrett is. And if she does not recuse herself from some of these controversial cases involving the election and election law and voting rights immediately, then that kind of proves what the Democrats have said when they said that she wasn't the right person to take the job now. And it proves the case. But I'm ready to be, I mean, all she can do is prove herself either that she's going to be ethical and recuse herself from these controversial cases, or she can just go ahead and participate in them. And then we'll see how she votes, and we'll see what arguments she makes and make our judgment. We don't have much choice now. She's a seated court justice.
I also think that you could see her surprising people on a number of votes. You've seen Justice Roberts, who was the Federalist Society's pick. He was George Bush's pick. The Democrats fought, you know, tooth and nail against John Roberts, and he now, over a number of the most important cases coming into the Supreme Court, has sided with the progressives. I think you could easily see Amy Coney Barrett doing that on a number of cases. Nobody knows how she's going to decide once she's on the court on these big cases.
Even though I'm a great respecter of JP and his cousin, PJ, I have to say that I don't think you're right. Let's try to remember the politics of this. The Bushes clearly hate Trump's guts. And the Bushes are the ones who are responsible for John Roberts. He doesn't owe anything to this president. She does. Period.
I have to agree with Alan on this. Clarence Thomas certainly has not surprised us with any nuanced thinking and surprising decisions, and I believe she's in the same ilk.
All right, let's go to some other letters. And Wesley says the SCOTUS has given up all pretense of being independent. The travesty of the sham swearing in on the illegitimate RPG replacement was more in line with the type of thing done in a banana republic. There should be mass demonstrations at the Supreme Court. Belarus and Hong Kong should be our guide for how to react when faced with authoritarianism. Virginia says if/when Biden wins, and if/when he gets a Democratic Senate, he should quickly and add 3 seats to the Supreme Court, bringing it to 12, just as in a normal jury, having it be split 6 to the right politically, 6 to the left. To come to a decision, one side would have to make a convincing enough argument and legally sound enough argument to be able to bring one or more from the other side over to their way of thinking. And that way, cases would have to be argued on the merits, not based on ideology. And if it can't be done, then it's a hung jury and the lower court ruling stands. Who says the number on the Supreme Court has to be an uneven number? Lincoln had 10. Better to have 12 angry men and women than 200 million livid Americans. And then maybe those on the court will mean out what his or her title implies, justice. Good letter.
It's a very thoughtful letter, I think. I'm kind of leery about adding justices to the court right out of the gate, but that's a very strong case for it.
We go.
I want him at it right out of the gate, and I think it should be 4, only because I think there are 4 great candidates: Barack Obama, Merrick Garland, a black woman to be determined. There are several candidates, and I do think that it makes for. That's interesting about the even versus the odd number, because we have so many decisions of life and death matters that are decided by ultimately one vote that it's scary. So
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Does anyone know if there's an equivalent liberal version of the Federalist Society that has a list that's been vetted?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, Rosemary has a list. I mean, that's one good list.
Yeah, I have a list. They can consult me at any time.
go to it. All right, we go to, let's see, we'll go to this letter, which I had right in front of me. Yes, regarding Amy Coney Barrett, her personal beliefs aside, how about her lack of experience? See Mother Jones. Reportedly, she never argued in a case, an appeal, nor a case before the Supreme Court. The court and the country deserve a justice with more experience.
They said that about Earl Warren.
Well, that's the difficulty, too, of getting them as young as you possibly can and then getting somebody experienced, right?
Yeah, it's a risk.
Did somebody let a chicken loose on one of the phones?
I thought it was Morse code, actually. Yeah. Maybe it's a chicken doing Morse code.
I'm not hearing it. Is it me? Because I'm not hearing it, but I'm just sitting at my kitchen table, not chicken noises.
I think it may be coming through in JP's line, weirdly, but we'll...
I stopped it.
Okay.
I stopped the action.
Okay, great.
Well, what was it?
I was looking up Democratic Federalist Society. I couldn't find it.
Oh, I see.
Oh, it was the computer working.
It was a fact checking.
Apparently, it was the computer used in old Get Smart episodes. Keith writes, yes to 12 on the court, Obama as the first, and agreeing with Rosemary on that. We also... go to this letter. What do you all think of Senator Markey's comments? Originalism is racist. Originalism is sexist. Originalism is homophobic. Originalism is just a fancy word for discrimination. Do you think he is correct?
Yeah, I think all of those things can be justified. Racism, sexism, bigotry can be justified under originalism. But the idea of originalism is the intent of the founders. And while they did all the politics and kept enslaved people and women out, their intent was freedom and equal opportunity for all. That was the ideal. And so if you follow originalism to its real, real meaning, no, I don't think it's any of those things. I think it's highly idealistic and not a bad thing.
Andrew writes, returning the filibuster to the process of selecting judges would aid in depoliticizing that process. Removing the filibuster from the Senate would focus the politics of governing on the next election, always less than 2 years away, which is where politics belongs. We have a lot to talk about. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're a week away from Election Day. There's a lot of campaigning going on, and maybe not amongst all of the candidates. So I want to talk about that when we come back. We will take on that as well as your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So caution and confidence keep Joe Biden close to home in the final days. The Democrat is gambling that his low profile amid the pandemic compared to Trump's massive rallies and frenetic travel schedule will pay off. The last 10 days of a presidential campaign is typically a frenzied spectacle of barnstorming candidates hitting multiple swing states daily. This is not the type of campaign that Joe Biden has been running. On Sunday, he held no campaign events. On Monday, he stayed close to home in Wilmington, Delaware, making only a brief surprise local stop where he signaled he traveled to swing states between then and Election Day. And that was after spending much of last week off the trail as he prepared for the final debate. By contrast, Trump crisscrossed the country over the weekend, holding multiple events in swing states. He held three in Pennsylvania alone yesterday. His campaign said that pace is only expected to ramp up. As many as six events in a single day will be held in the run-up to Election Day. A lot of Democrats are concerned, Alan, that Joe Biden is not out enough and doing enough. What do you think?
Well, I share that concern, to be honest with you. I mean, I wish he were doing a little bit more. On the other hand, I want to point out that for some reason, you know, Biden is way ahead or has been ahead consistently in the national polls and in most, if not all, of the crucial state polls. So put it a different way, he's doing something right.
JP?
Yeah, I think Biden so far has run a near flawless campaign. Their hypothesis at the beginning is that this election is going to be a referendum on Trump. And you can see the, you know, as Alan said, the poll numbers are paying off. You know, Joe's, I think their goal was to not allow the Republicans to paint him as a radical left candidate. And you've seen him on issue after issue go towards the middle. He said he's, you know, not interested in court packing. He has not really embraced the Green New Deal. He has supported the police. He's said, you know, he's okay with fracking. I thought he did a great job in both debates. You know, Donald Trump is not an easy guy to debate, and Biden did really well in both debates. And then, you know, he's known as a gaffe-prone candidate, and I can't think of any real gaffes that he's made over the last 3 months. So I think that Biden has certainly surprised me in how good of a campaign he's run.
Rosemary, it does seem weird, though, as the article from Politico states that you have a candidate a week before the election who's staying home for a day. That's odd.
I think our ideas on campaigning are extremely outmoded. They're from the last century. I never got it with Hillary, too. If she went to Madison twice, she would have won the state. She would have gotten those 23,000 votes. Especially this year, we're seeing that minds are already made up. Joe can have a lot more influence, and I think he knows that staying at home and coming out with thoughtful policy and impassioned speeches about the future of the country. I'm looking forward to a speech at Warm Springs, which is going to be a call for unity. I think that he'll make a lot more headlines that way. And as for gaffes, yeah, I mean, everything is a gaffe if you're an honest politician. He said the oil and gas industry has to transition, and that was on front page news all this week. So Joe, whether he stays home or he goes into a debate, can still make news because of who he is. I think he's smart to do it this way. And he's also sending Kamala out everywhere. She's been everywhere, and so are other surrogates. So I think our idea is that the candidate, in order to win, has to pull a Trump and have one massive rally after another. I think that's really, really has been outdated.
So,
go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, the thing I love about Kamala is that she's having fun. And
yeah.
I think the American people need some of that.
Yeah, the dancing, the Kamala dance. I just love that.
She's laughing.
Yeah, and laughing and having enjoying meeting the people and talking and being very honest.
She's a real natural. She's a Bill Clinton type politician. She just connects.
So let's talk for a moment, Mike, about if there's anything you want to say about that, but also of the Biden strategy. If you look at the electoral map of the states where that a possibility of Georgia going Democratic, something that hasn't happened since 1992, Biden will be in Georgia and Iowa, going to Iowa, for goodness sakes. What do you make of that strategy?
Well, I think it's bold, as people have pointed out, and it does demonstrate a confidence at the same time Trump seems to be self-destructing. You know, we were just talking about Kamala and her wonderful laugh. Well, he attacked her about that laugh, and then he attacked, you know, Samantha Guthrie, and he attacked, you know, Leslie Stahl and Nancy Pelosi. And then he says, I'm winning the suburban women. You know, he's not. Every survey I've read shows that they were crucial. Suburban white women were crucial to Trump's win in 2016, and they have abandoned him. And the New York Times has a fascinating story today about how they followed him around and they went to listen to his stumpy speeches. And he had, in one case, 137 misstatements, lies, falsehoods in the 90-minute address that he's giving everywhere. And I think that's just causing self-destruction. But one of them is that Biden is home. He's home now in his basement in Delaware, watching us right now and doing nothing. That's a lie. He is out there. He's just out there at a reasonable pace that's cautious, that demonstrates a respect for people's health and safety. And I think these super rallies that Trump is trying to hold. Mm. I mean, they're basically potential super spreaders, every single one of them. And the sadness is now a lot of them, because we're so close to the election, a lot of the infections that are going to be spread by them won't be we won't be aware of them numerically until after November 3rd. And it's going to it's just a very risky and I think self-destructive pattern that Trump is now on.
Remember at the beginning of the pandemic when there were these pictures as the lockdown was occurring, and there would be these pictures that would come out and say, oh, look at this pool party that took place in Miami, and it would show thousands of people and they're on the balconies and they're jumping off the balconies into the pools. The pictures from the rally yesterday in Monroeville, Pennsylvania reminded me of that. I mean, I just have never seen so many people in my life that were just
close together,
clammed
right,
together.
And unmasked.
Unmasked largely, unmasked, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I'd
really like to just say something here, because I want to tell you about all the people I'm meeting and what they're saying. There is a concern. We haven't really raised it this today, but there's a general concern trumpeted and backed up by the president's sister, and that is the niece, which is he says what he means, and I think what he's saying is he's going to steal this election. He wants her on the court. Why? Because he's going to need her when he contests this election. I think the thing that is scaring the hell out of everybody is not, you know, the closeness of the election, because if it's a legitimate election, Biden wins. I think what everybody's scared of is that he's going to steal it. One way or the other, he's going to attempt to steal it, which is the way that fascists and totalitarians get started. I think that is why people are having stomach aches.
I agree, and it seems to be Pennsylvania is the one that he has his eye on, the state, where a lot of this will emanate from. He said yesterday in Pennsylvania that if he doesn't win, it's because the election was a fraud and it was stolen from him.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pennsylvania is the battleground. It's where most of the, you know, the campaigning is going on and the money is being spent. And it's a very divided state. When you look at the rural parts of Pennsylvania, you drive through there, all you see is Trump signs in the rural parts of the state. And then the cities, of course, at either end, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are very pro-democratic, but it's a metaphor for the people who supported Trump in 2016 and those who didn't, and it's the battleground. It really is the way Pennsylvania goes is the way the country goes. At least that's the way the Trump campaign is approaching it.
Rosemary?
I wish there were some reform that Democrats could at some point in the future work on that would not pit one part of the country, rural, against another, urban, and stop it. It's absolutely unfair that conservative areas, rural areas, states with small population have outsized control. We saw that in the election of the appointment, rather, of Amy Comey Bryant, where senators representing a much smaller part of the population had the big say in whether she got on the court or not. That is absolutely unfair. I know it's embedded in the Constitution, but it's the 21st century. We do not.
Well, electoral college reform is what I think you're partly talking about, and that has to happen. The states have to do something about this disproportionate, unfair system. Unfortunately, when a political party is in power, they don't want to do anything because they got there.
We have breaking news, Joe, out of another court loss for Trump. The court is saying that the Justice Department cannot defend him in a defamation suit brought by one of the many women who say he went after them.
Is that the E. Jean Carroll case? Okay.
Yes.
That's interesting. So we'll find out more on that during the, yeah, I'm sorry, what?
Probably we'll go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And we pretty know what we can find there, pretty well know what we can expect there.
Another test.
But if he loses the election, that kind of takes care of that, doesn't it? Because it wouldn't be his Justice Department anymore.
Yeah, and as I've said so many times, if Schmiff, I mean, you know, we can only hope that somehow justice, legitimacy, and frankly, the I hate to quote Superman, the American way prevails.
Ish, is it if, smish? What was that expression, Alan?
I forgot.
Yeah.
Oh, Smith.
I think if you just put an I and then put your elbow down on the keyboard, it comes out right.
Yeah, okay.
We're gonna take
it was Yiddish.
When we come back, we'll take. Is it at all? We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a wonderful panel: Alan, Mike, Rosemary, and JP. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. I can't believe it's a week from till Election Day. And yet it's going to seem a lot longer, isn't it? It just seems as though it will seem a lot longer. J.P., when you look at the electoral map, what do you see?
I see the real importance of Florida. You know, we were talking about Pennsylvania. It looks like Pennsylvania, with each poll that comes out, is getting further and further out of Trump's reach to try and make a play there. I think that Florida right now, if you look at the Real Clear Politics average of the number of polls, I see a 2-point race there. And it's very hard for Biden to win without Florida. It's very hard for Trump to win without Florida. So I think that as we watch TV, much like we did 4 years ago, we're going to be watching the returns in Florida. And I think that's where the election is going to be won or lost. Although I would say that in the final week, it looks like Biden has a clear edge going into Election Day.
Well, yes. But on the other hand, JP, one of the reasons they have Obama in Florida today is they know that he's extraordinarily popular there, and they know that that's where the cookies are. So you're right. This is going to be a very important place to be.
President Obama was there on Saturday, I believe.
And he's there today, too.
And he's there this afternoon. He was in Miami over the weekend. He's back again today. I believe he also will be in Pennsylvania again and making quite a few appearances. Rosemary, do you think that helps?
Does what help?
Obama.
Is out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. He's actually wonderful to watch as he campaigns. It reminds you of what a president should be like, sort of like watching West Wing. I'm concerned about all the early voting, which is momentous. People want their vote to count. They're extremely worried, as well they should be if they're listening to our president. And I think it's great that they're out there. The latest studies show that it's overwhelmingly Democrats, which had worried me because lots of new voters going out seem to have been roused by Trump, not Biden. However, what happens on Election Day? Well, the studies also show that Republicans tend to go out in person on Election Day. Will we just end up with the same dismal rate of voting as usual with a much smaller turnout on Election Day? I want to know what that means. I also think that Ohio is in play, that race has tightened. Biden's edge is extremely small there. And I think going after Texas and Georgia, very nice to think about, but I just can't see it happening.
Hmm. You want to hear something extremely anecdotal? I'm labeling that. This is extremely anecdotal. But last night I was talking to my class via Zoom, 25 kids. I offered them a coupon, a get out of an assignment free card, if they could prove to me that they had voted. show me a sticker, show me a picture of you in front of the polling place, something, and I'll give you, and I don't care, obviously don't care who you vote for, I just want you to go out and vote.
You're
and,
not the first.
And I said to the, right, and I said to the kids, so will that do? And I said, how many of you, how many of you, have any of you actually voted yet? Out of the 25, 23 kids said that they had already voted.
Wow.
I mean,
wow,
that,
that's huge.
It, right? I was shocked.
Huge.
Absolutely shocked. It is very, and that was about half and half of absentee and early voting. But to your point, Rosemary, I don't know. Yeah, that's going to be an interesting thing. Are we going to see the same dismal numbers that we do? Or is that youth vote that we keep hearing is could really make a difference? Is that going to come out?
Right.
Rosemary, I have a comment on Georgia. You know, I have a very good friend of mine who is doing phone calling for the Biden campaign, where you can easily go on the website and get your phone to dial voters. You have to do a training, but they're an active volunteer for the Biden campaign, and they were calling Georgia this past weekend. They had my good friend calling Georgia voters. Didn't have as much luck there as they had in Ohio, but it is something that the Biden campaign is actually trying to win Georgia. I think it's more than just a head fake, which you sometimes see in the last dwindling days of an election campaign, say, oh, we're going into X state or we're going into Y state. I do think they are trying to make a play for Georgia. I'm not saying they're going to win it, but they're at least trying.
He's within Senate races in there, too. So the more play in Georgia, the better for Democrats overall. So I'm still in favor of it. It's such a mind-blowing thing to think that a state like Georgia could go Democratic. If the black vote is as heavy as the millennial vote, as the young people vote, I mean, then Biden, that's the alliance that could really bring Biden home. That would be awesome.
And you also have Kamala Harris. I'm sorry, Mike. You also have Kamala Harris in Texas this week too.
Texas. That I was going to mention Texas. I mean, Biden is within the margin of error in Texas. Now, I'm not saying he's going to win Texas, but the fact that he's doing so well there, the odd thing is that Trump seems to be gaining the majority of Hispanic voters in Texas, which I don't know how that's going to shift in the next week. But there is a whole thing. Isn't there a political scientist, Dr. Shartok?
Yeah, there
momentum.
Is.
Once momentum picks up, I mean, it becomes – that's what happened with Reagan in 1980. Once the momentum picks up, it can really surprise you by the end of the week.
Big Mo is huge. And I think Texas, which is pretty reliably Republican, has a shot here for the Democrats. And we have seen them elected Democratic, Ann Richards and others, Democratic governor from time to time. So it's not impossible.
As you talk about momentum, that's another thing that I wanted to bring up was. There has not been what I would call a big last-minute October surprise. I think the Republicans were trying to manufacture one with the Hunter Biden stuff, but there hasn't been that big, Access Hollywood tape or the big, the Comey investigation into Hillary's servers. Those, when I think about the 2016 election, those were the two big, last couple weeks bombshell in there. And over the last 10 days, I've been surprised there hasn't been one, and I'd be surprised if by the end of the week there isn't one.
Well, what more do you want? I mean, we had Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying. You had the president getting COVID. You had the debate. I don't know. What more do we need?
Joe, that's not an October surprise manufactured by the president. I think JP's point is extremely well taken, which is he still has a week to pull a fast one. And we know he's a master of fast ones. So, all of those things, you're quite right, were dramatic. But, it is true that the one thing that they did try, obviously, was this this whole business with the Hunter Biden thing. But that
wasn't the only thing they tried. I'm surprised this hasn't gotten more attention. But at the end of Leslie Stahl's interview, Trump has his press secretary bring in a gigantic box of books.
Yes.
It's almost like, and says, here is the health plan. And I don't know what that was supposed to accomplish. I think they released the film early, but it ends with that. And then did they expect Leslie Stahl not to go through the box? And in it is nothing but declarations, executive orders, and congressional intent, which is not even the same thing as a bill, much less a plan. And I think that was an attempt to have an October surprise. Definitely the Hunter Biden story. Mm-hmm. When that was that might have worked, by the way. The Wall Street Journal appears to have been close to writing the story until Giuliani and Bannon messed it up by going to the New York Post and then throwing the whole thing into question. Mm-hmm. And I think October surprises have become like a technique on both sides. The Borat movie with Rudy Giuliani. Why is he not under indictment, by the way? But anyway,
there is that. The thing, when
the world makes you think he won't be pardoned the moment they do that, you know, Rosemary.
Okay,
you know,
I would even like that. I want his name blackened. It still hasn't been. He's still running around as if he's a legit person.
Back to the Kelly McEnany thing, and I realize I hope I don't offend anyone by this. I'm this is not a sexist statement. I don't mean it to be a sexist statement. I just mean it to be. But are leather pants part of the White House dress code?
Kaylee is the one. I'm the one who always makes comments on people's physicality, and Kaylee's the one who made the sleeveless sheath de rigueur uniform for Trumpettes. And so now, yes, she's gone to leather pants. She's a very beautiful woman, as is Hope Hicks, and Trump likes that and uses that. And women who fall for it are part of his enabling machine. It's despicable.
So
they fell for it the last election, that's for sure. And that's why this business of the suburban housewife, so-called suburban housewife, changing. The very same people who voted with him last time are not voting with him this time. So something has really changed.
But it's a page right out of the Roger Ailes playbook for Fox News.
Right.
I mean, bombshells. It's to put stunning looking women up in front, you know, show legs, show shoulder, whatever. And it's a distraction, and it was very effective on Fox News. And who influences the president more than anybody else? Fox News.
So, Rosemary, I have two questions for you. One is, what did you make of the story about the Wall Street Journal and their vetting of the Hunter Biden story?
Oh, I think that's really fascinating, and I hope the Media Project will take that up. They were fed information about Hunter Biden's emails, and it's true that we are not in the mainstream media looking at those emails in the same way that we looked at the leaked Hillary emails, saying, oh, well, the source isn't important. We have to look at the content. There is a story about influence peddling by children of the presidents, and I include the Trumps in that as well as Hunter Biden. So the Wall Street Journal put two really reputable journalists on it. They were going to town investigating and probably would have come out with a story. But as the Wall Street Journal wrote, there's no evidence, documentary or named source or unnamed source, except for, well, that's named, Bannon and Rudy Giuliani saying Joe Biden fell into it, played along with his son, had any involvement at all. The story is about influence peddling by those close to the presidents. And has that not been a story for decades? Look at Clinton's brother. Look at Carter's relatives. It is an interesting nepotism and influence peddling. That's a legit story, and I think that's what the Wall Street Journal was working on until Giuliani and Bannon jumped the gun, worried that the Wall Street Journal wasn't going to have anything. They went to the New York Post, and that blew the story up, and the Wall Street Journal cannot, as a reputable newspaper, come out after that and say, oh, yeah, here's the real story.
It was similar.
Really fascinating.
It was fascinating because you wonder what they would have come up with. And then the Trump campaign kept on waiting for that story to drop, and it didn't, which got them worried, which is why they went to the Post. The other thing is that Wesley Stahl continually saying during the interview with Trump that was conducted a week ago, but aired on Sunday, where she said, "Mr. President, we're 60 Minutes. We can't air something that hasn't been verified." To which the president said, "Go down and look at the papers. It's been verified because it's in the New York Post."
Yep.
Well, Rosemary, don't you think the media handled the New York Post story most responsibly? I mean, in the end.
Who did? The Wall Street Journal?
The other news media. The way that they vetted it and they reported.
Yeah, Post and the New York Times immediately came out after the Post story with a story about the story. How did that story come into play? It should immediately have been red flagged because it came from Bannon and Giuliani, who are not, the motives of those sources truly had to be questioned, and the Post did not. Well, I guess except by some reporters who took their names off the story, which is a lovely gesture, but really not a well-known gesture outside of the journalism community. Hunter Biden is a story. I talked about that 2 years ago.
You did.
On the roundtable.
True.
That what he was doing was suspicious, and I think it should be looked at. But to connect that now, a week or so before the election with his father, that's a whole different thing.
JP?
Yeah, I think that you're going to see in the weeks after, assuming Biden wins the presidency, in the weeks after his win, you're going to see the mainstream media all of a sudden pick up this story and say, "Well, actually, look at this. These emails are real. There was, there is a scandal here. Let's investigate it." And you will see stories about it after the Biden win.
You mean you think the media is holding off on responsible reporting about this story until after they see Biden win? That does seem a little. I mean, these emails are supposed to have come from a laptop that Hunter Biden left at a Delaware computer repair shop and then forgot about it. And the guy in the shop opened up the hard drive and then copied all the documents, printed them out, and handed them to Rudy Giuliani. I mean,
that can happen. That can happen.
Oh, it can. Yeah.
and he was blind. Don't forget, he's legally blind, so he couldn't.
That's
really
true. He was visually impaired. That's true. So he may not have seen what was on.
As outlandish as that is, I was ready in 2016 to support the idea that Hillary's emails came from the Russians, came directly from Putin's office, let's say, but the content of the emails still was a story. Why is that changed now? If you just discount that whole lie about where they came from, no one's ever said those weren't Hunter Biden's emails. And there is a story in there. And apparently there's a disgruntled former business employer, a business partner of Hunter's, who's saying, yeah, we were going after Joe to get him to sign on with us. That's a story. In the same way that Ivanka and Eric and Donnie Jr.'s attempts to enrich themselves out of the White House is a story. We should be looking at that. But the press now is saying, is it responsible to look at it now in the context of a presidential race? That's what was missing in 2016.
Given that we just have a few moments before we go over to break, I have some letters I want to read too. But while I have the journalists here, let me ask this question. We did talk about this yesterday, but what did you all make of the questions and the performance of the two journalists who were questioning both candidates? That would be Nora O'Donnell and Wesley Stahl. JP?
I only watched the Leslie Stahl portion, and I thought she did a nice job. And I think that, the Trump campaign chooses who he gives interviews to this close to an election. Choosing Leslie Stahl was a strategic move. It's something that, Trump wanted to beat up on a reporter, I think. They chose Leslie Stahl to do it on. And I thought she did a fine job. I didn't think any of her questions were unfair. I did not watch Nora O'Donnell interview Biden.
Rosemary?
Okay, so first of all, there were two women. I think that's interesting considering Trump's history. He does not like to be done, to be shown up by a woman. And I think that JP is right. He wanted to dominate. And he did not. Leslie Stahl is just a terrific, terrific broadcast interviewer. My favorite question was when she said, "Do you remember what you told me about?"
Oh, yeah.
That was such a good question.
Do you remember what?
Do you remember that when you told me that when you say fake, This is Donald Trump telling Leslie Stahl this, that he said that he would continually say things were fake because that way, when they said something that he didn't like, he could delegitimize it.
When he said something, when the press said something bad about him, no one was believing it. Direct attack
yes.
on credibility. And that tape with that taped interview with Leslie Stahl is in the public record. She asked him about that. That was my favorite question, and he just demurred. And I thought the other thing I did was I listened to the whole 37 minutes that Trump released, thinking that that would absolve him. It did not. And then I listened to the Joe Biden interview. He was not asked softball questions. The questions to Biden were as hard as the ones that Leslie Stahl put to the president. Anybody else watch both and could agree with that?
I disagree in the sense that I didn't think I agree that they're not that they were soft that they were not softball questions. I do not think they were as well crafted questions as say Kristen Welker and Chris O'Donnell.
Nora is not the same caliber of journalist as Leslie Stahl.
She was taking points to me. She was taking talking points from the Trump administration as if they were true and saying, "Are you a Trojan horse and are going to come in and just be socialists and liberals and take over?" And I thought those questions just
were kind of
silly.
Yeah, that was kind of a dumb question.
Yeah.
So Rosemary, do you think?
Are you a socialist progressive? And she just
laughed in her face. You know? Right. Yeah.
So. What I wanted to know from Rosemary, who is a logistics person, do you think Trump knew before he walked out there with Stahl that he was going to get up and walk out?
That's a great question, Alan. I want to hear your opinion of it, because I looked at it, both the full bore thing and what 60 Minutes edited it down. And, yeah, I think he was bristling from the very beginning. I don't know if he thought he'd walk out, but I definitely think he was ready for a fight.
Don't you think it's appropriate, though, that when a journalist interviews Donald Trump, it's like a prosecutor taking on a hostile witness? I mean, it is so predetermined that he's against you from the moment it begins.
Well, I mean, Rosemary, go ahead. I was just going to say that.
I was just going to say briefly that you have to, as a journalist, not take that bait. Like, he called her fake media and you do this and you do that. He was insulting and a jerk, the whole thing. And she never just said, "We're not the fake media, stop that." She never made herself or the media the issue, which is right. We're not.
Which is just a symptom
of what he's doing to the electorate.
But for every journalist here, and I've certainly done it a number of times, it is not at all out of line what to sit down at a person and just say, "Hey, are you ready for some tough questions?" Right? I mean, that's what, isn't that the job? Isn't that what you're supposed to do? It's like he took such offense to that.
That was a conversational gambit. Later on, she goes, "You know, I thought you liked this. You like being challenged."
Right.
I think she then was becoming aware that what was in play, that he was really going to walk out or do something, have an angry explosion.
It's a great question.
She was trying to get it back.
It's a great question, Alan, because you do wonder if whether he got kind of caught up and was going to do it earlier. But I thought when Leslie Stahl looked at him and said, "Look, I didn't want it to be this way," that she could not have been more sincere. And she did look crestfallen, just like, "I didn't want it to be this way." And he goes, "Sure you did. This is exactly what you wanted to do. You want people to vote for Biden." And it just, you know.
It was after 37 minutes. They had interviewed for 37 minutes, right?
Correct.
So he had his cake and eat it, too. He went through a hard interview, or what appeared to be a hard interview, and then he still got to repudiate the interviewer by getting up and walking out. It's both.
Could I just say that was not a hard interview? One of the questions was, "What do you want to accomplish in your second term?" Is that hard?
Well, I think that is a hard interview. I think that's an important question. And the fact that he doesn't have an answer and he had no new platform is right there.
It's like Sarah Palin saying it was a hard interview when Katie Couric asked her what newspaper she read. That's not a gotcha question.
Not supposed to be.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up when on the other side. We'll be right back. I'm on the hunt, I'm after you. Mouth is alive, juice is like wine. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last call with Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. Last go-round on the panel, about another 15 minutes, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We got these letters. Eric says, JP said that Biden couldn't win without Florida. Not true. The 538 interactive model gives Biden a 64% chance of winning even if he loses Florida. If Biden holds Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, plus all of the 2016 Hillary states, he wins. I recommend the 538 website to follow the polls and get a – oh, we know all about that. But thank you, Eric. Yes, that's good.
we do indeed.
it's a tab right on – I play with it constantly. That one and the map on the Times where you can just move everything around, it's
yeah,
pretty
cool.
Great. Let's see. Ali says, I felt the Stahl Trump interview was not strong or persuasive on behalf of the interviewer. When Trump proclaimed he had created the best economy ever, she responded coyly and demurely. Well, she said that's not true, but okay. As a journalist, it was her responsibility to challenge him with facts, not personality.
Wait a minute. Coyly and demurely. First of all, that's sexist. Jake Tapper said the same thing to him. That's not true. And there is evidence, and it's been presented, and Trump knows this. I don't think she got a chance to say, look, I can point to this study and that study and this result. But he just was already attacking that. But, you know, I did wonder, because I'm a journalist, and so I like the way she interviews, which was I think she's a terrific interviewer, but I wondered if that would offend some people who are not journalists, who see any question to someone in authority as a lack of respect. What do you guys think?
Well, I thought it was a polar opposite approach to Norah O'Donnell, who was like an automatron, just hurling questions with no emotion whatsoever. I don't think you have to. I think she was. Was very professional and did it with a certain amount of confidence and coolness and collectiveness, but also not bashing him over the head either.
I like emotion.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, Rosemary, I think that's a really good question generally about whether. When people see a journalist interviewing a public official, a politician especially, and they're hitting him with hard questions and they're questioning the answers and challenging them, it can mm-hmm. give the public who really don't know the whole process. It's like, you know, seeing the sausage being made.
Yes.
But it is adversarial. It is often adversarial. It needs to be adversarial sometimes. It doesn't have to be adversarial. But when you're challenging somebody who has, who is citing questionable, versions of stories, it is completely appropriate. But I do worry that when people see it, they sort of get lost in the moment and say, see, it's the fake news. See, they're against him. See, they want him to lose. I mean, it does... unfortunately, feed that narrative.
That's a great answer, Mike. And I know when I teach overseas, journalists there see the Western style. That's what it is, Western style of interviewing, which is it's sort of a conversation, but it really isn't. The journalist has to be in charge in order to get the information out. They see that as adversarial and rude. So it does make me wonder about our audiences.
It also, I think you made a great point earlier, Rosemary, of the fact that they released the 37-38 minutes that Trump released that as if it was a smoking gun, see what they're going to do to me. It was fascinating to see an unedited interview from 60
yes.
Minutes. I mean, that's cool, but...
Yeah, that's why I watched both of them. I
right.
wanted to see where they... Yep.
But if anything, it was not it only showed that she tried really hard to just to keep it to an interview and to get answers to the questions she was asking.
Yep.
Let's go to the letters. Anthony says, please, I spotted that planned walkout 10 years ago. It was so staged and so planned. How can anyone believe that? Don't you guys get it? These people have not been able to pull off even the simplest of cons in the past 4 years. That makes what makes this any different? All right. That'll show
What's the matter
us.
With you guys?
Yeah. Nicole says, my question is, if we accept Trump is not that smart and was not a Washington insider, who was behind the idea of packing all the courts? Steve Bannon, maybe? Well, that would be Mitch McConnell, right?
Mitch McConnell, sure. And you know, one thing about that, just to go back to the first thing we talked about, that does remind people, some people, who are single issue voters who are anti-gay or anti-abortion, it does remind them that even though they may not like Trump, they may not like his tweets, he delivered what he promised 4 years ago, and that is to pack the court with conservatives, you know, off the list that the Federalist Society delivered to him. And that coming right before the election was certainly part of the, you know, the whole calculus here.
You know, Mike, one of the reasons that he had this ceremony, this induction last night, was that he thought it was going to work in his favor, I am quite sure. In other words, I got this done. I think, on the contrary, it's just going to infuriate an awful lot of Democrats who are going to get out and vote because of it.
It may well, or they may have already voted.
By the way, I just want to say that I don't agree with the general feeling that the Republicans will control the day of the election. I think the Democrats will. And I just want to be on record as having said that, because the common thought here is that the Republicans will come out and vote on Election Day and they'll carry that day. I don't think so.
So that is a good point, because when do the in-person early votes, do they immediately get counted?
The votes do. They get counted election night, not the absentee ballots.
Yeah.
The absentee ballots don't. Yeah. Okay. I mean, they may in some cases get counted after the polls close at 7 p.m. in some states. But
so then I agree with Alan.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
way to go.
There's a good piece today in the Times on the front page about people who don't vote. I mean, the numbers are in the high 50s and low 60s of people who vote. So that's very low turnout for a democracy, a Western democracy. And, you know, what happens is people just become so disillusioned by the acrimony of the political process. They just decide to drop out, and they don't want any part of it. They don't like it, and they don't vote. And you know, in some cases, a few of them that the Times interviewed are going to vote this time, and they found people voting for each candidate. But that's a factor too, whether some of these non-voters from previous years decide to vote because everybody is compelling them to.
So
how about laziness and ignorance?
Well, laziness, ignorance. But there's another
those
factor.
Those time-honored favorites.
Yeah. They work two jobs. They got kids. They don't know. They can't get to the polls. They don't really they're not paying attention because it depresses them. You know, all kinds of reasons.
We got this letter from, get ready, I don't know if related or not, but from PJ, who says, Peggy Noonan has attacked Kamala Harris as frivolous and embarrassing. Please discuss. Biden must make a couple of more trips. Well, this gets into how you feel about Peggy Noonan, which I'm sure.
Not good.
Yeah.
She's a good speechwriter.
I have not read that. Have any of you read it?
I did not hear that, no.
No, I had not read it either.
No.
Okay, you gave us homework, listener. We will do that. Boy, I sure don't think she comes off as frivolous and definitely not embarrassing. I think she's kind of inspiring and, as we said earlier today, fun.
I don't know.
And every time I look at her, I get the feeling she may well end up as the president of the United States. I mean, I think the chances are pretty good.
Well, that's despite the president's assertion at his rallies. She will never be president of the United States, he says.
So she wrote an op-ed, apparently. It's a Peggy Noonan for calling vice presidential. Yeah, so she wrote an op-ed. I don't know where it first appeared, though. That's what I'm trying to find.
I think it was in the Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal.
And the interesting thing I would say about Peggy Noonan is she is, of course, a historically conservative Republican columnist, but throughout Trump's term, she has gone from being a strong Trump critic to a somewhat backing Trump, back to being a critic, back to backing him. So when you read Peggy Noonan's columns, you don't quite know what you're going to get each week. And she did take a shot at Senator Harris. And she said, if I remember the column correctly, she said something like, people won't say that, non-females can't say this, so I will. And I think that's where the critique came in her column, towards the bottom.
All right. Let's see. We have more letters that I want to get in our 2 minutes left. Must disagree, says Paul. Biden needs to switch to Harry Truman speed. So many Americans respect a high energy campaign closer. Biden's sluggish approach underscores the Sleepy Joe moniker. He can be energetic and COVID careful. Jason says that Trump has forever changed the political landscape. He's given us a new metric, forgive the acronym, LPM, lives per minute. Avery says Anita Hill is a highly qualified law professor, right? Can she be appointed to the court? Penny for your thoughts, says Avery.
That'd be a very interesting appointment.
She's on your list?
The Rosemary list versus the Federalist list.
That would be
some
program.
She's awesome, and just to see her and Thomas on the same decision would be interesting. I doubt that it would happen because of that reason, but maybe he'll be off soon. He's an old guy now.
All right, we're out of time. So in a week, when we all get together, when this group gets together, it'll be Election Day.
Wow.
and we'll just be spinning our wheels wondering what the American people are doing out there. So we'll find out. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Rosemary, Mike, and JP, always a pleasure. We'll talk next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up next, we'll have the Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.